We welcome in our friend, author Colin Fleming. Hello, Colin.
What's going on, Kimball?
I'm just, again, in awe of your awesomeness out there on those steps. Did I see right at 10,000 steps the other day?
10,000 on Saturday, 5,000 each day since, up to 25,000. As you know, you want to get to 20,000 each week. 30,000, those are really nice numbers. And 40,000 is a rarefied number. So I'm going to try to keep on pace and finish out these next 3 days of the week and get to that 40.
Now, you posted a picture of some steps the other day. I don't know if that was in a government center, but they looked like they were what I would call in-betweeners. They weren't like full steps, and I wondered if that impacts your work on those, because you might have to adjust a little bit.
That's where that was from. I would say it's a lot of sort of small mincing steps. You have to be careful. It's a lot of quick feet, I guess is how you would look at it.
Mm.
And if someone is walking up those stairs two at a time, it's hard if you're doing one at a time to keep their pace. But all stairs are different, and they, as long as you get the number in, they're going to give you the same sort of workout. But yeah, it's a lot different. The stairs in the monument, for instance, are quite a bit deeper, but you're not running as many or doing as many in numbers. So it varies from place to place. There are three railings for people to hold on to at government center when they're feeling tired. But that sort of became my stairs away from home, so to speak, when COVID set in and then all those weird monument hours. But I'm a fixture there.
Now, with those quick feet, Colin, would that enable you to be able to steal home?
I think there's a caginess involved in stealing home. Jackie Robinson, for instance, I don't know if he stole home the most. He could have, unless you're going way back to the turn of the century, and he had that shortened career at 11 years. But part of it is obviously not just speed. It's fun looking up all these home theft numbers. I think I mentioned that Ricky Henderson has 4. Kind of surprising, right?
Right. Have more. Right. I expected a lot more.
Fisk has 3. He's a catcher. Louis Aparicio with 0. My man, Dave Kingman, out stealing, at least of home, Louis Aparicio with 1. Kingman one day was like, you know what? You only live once. I'm going for it. I figure that's how. I'm not just about the home run. I'm primarily about the home run. But never let it be said that I didn't have a swipe of home on my resume. So, but Lance Parrish stole home. I'm just looking up all these guys who are my favorite guys. And it's funny to see. Nelly Fox has more, obviously, career home plate thefts than Louis Aparicio. And Aparicio led the league in stolen bases 9 times. So it's pretty cool if you want to dig up that information.
And I'm just picturing being a pitcher in the middle of your windup and you see out of the corner of your eye Dave Kingman lumbering down the third baseline. That has to affect your delivery a little bit.
It seems like one of those plays that shouldn't be allowed, because everyone is allowed to do a certain thing that can kill people. The pitcher is allowed to complete the pitch. You can be sliding right into that.
Mm.
The batter is allowed to swing. You don't have to leave, right? I mean, you might not, if you're a right-handed batter, you might not even know that someone is trying to steal home.
Right.
So it just seems it's a broken play before it begins. There's really nothing like it. It's quite a bit different now, too, because with the, what's the word that I can even allowably use? Well, let's just say with the gentleness of everything now, you're not even allowed to block the plate. So that's changed the nature of stealing home and defending the theft against that stolen base. But it's a cool thing. It's certainly that cherry that you want to have in your CV for these things that you've accomplished. But someone like Jackie Robinson, as I mentioned, was just so good at it. He must have had the rhythm down. It had to have been
right.
He knew when to go, and it's not a speed thing. Well, oftentimes stolen bases aren't an outright speed thing. Speed certainly helps. I don't think it has that much to do with stealing home, though.
No, when I was coaching high school baseball 100 years ago, if I was coaching third, I would have the guy on third walk down the third baseline with me, and it's all a matter of getting a big enough lead and realizing the level of attention that's being focused on you there. Now, Kerry, you looked up the all-time record. Was it Ty Cobb with 54 steals of home? Next best is Max Carey with 33.
So Robinson is, what's he at, 19?
Yeah, he is. He's 10th. He's actually tied for 9th all time.
And that really has a giant asterisk next to it, because his career didn't start when it ought to have started in the majors. And it was he began late, of course, and he had the 11-year career. But he was missing prime home theft stealing seasons. And it was a different game when Cobb played. Cobb would be the guy, too.
This one's surprising. Lou Gehrig, 15 steals of home.
Oh, Ruth had a mess of them as well. Yeah, they both definitely did. I mean, really, it's. I was looking up all those guys, and it was part of the job.
Right.
From, like, the pre-1930 era. You stole home, but you have a few. It's hard to find people who don't have a handful or a dozen in their career. And if you look at someone like Lou Gehrig, he's absolutely massive. He's massive by the standards of today's athlete. Mm. Look at his legs and his trunk, his torso. Just a huge guy. So maybe he pops somebody. I don't know. But it's cool. Yeah, it's definitely something that, I mean, I'm really slow. You'd think, like, this guy running the stairs is fleet of foot. I'm not. I'm a plodding runner. But I feel like that's why Fisk stole home 3 times. He didn't get thrown. I believe he got thrown out, like, 3 or 4 times trying to steal home. But he was such a smart ball player. He would catch you napping. He would know when he could go. And also, too, I don't know how many of these stolen thefts of home were double steals.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So people get caught up. I don't know for a fact that one day Kingman looked at the pitcher and said, on this next pitch, baby, I'm going. I don't know if that's what happened. I like to think that that's what happened, but it probably didn't. It probably was like he came in the back door of a double steal, and people were like, oh, damn, what just happened? Kingman scored.
Colin Fleming with us here on Downtown. Well, a fun discussion about stealing home, but that's not what we're here to talk about today. We're going to look back at one of the great films, not just one of the great film noirs of all time, but one of the best movies ever from 1947, Out of the Past. Everything about this movie is so well done.
And everything about this movie is, it gets pigeonholed in ways that it shouldn't. And there are so many reasons for that. Certain genres have just never fared well canonically with cinema. And it's not right. It's ignorant. It's elitist. Horror, comedy, this genre, film noir, they're never, or at least rarely, talked about as being the best that cinema can be. That sort of goes to the straight drama category. You won't often hear Buster Keaton or the Marx Brothers or Bride of Frankenstein getting the plaudits that they really do deserve. And this is one of those films. And I think also, film noir does pretty well for itself right now with movie buffs. Wouldn't you say?
Oh, absolutely.
Often talking about film noir. It has staying power. It has appeal to people. And sometimes, often, those people are boomers. But I really see it across all sorts of ages. There is something about this mid-century genre that people dig, that they can classify these films. But you know what? They often wrongly classify these films, and that bothers me, because any mid-century crime picture now almost automatically has the label noir applied to it. That's not how this works. It's not just a crime thing, and that's why Out of the Past is the touchstone definitive example of everything you need to have in a film for it to qualify as noir. And also as a film that transcends noir.
It's got a tremendous cast. I mean, Robert Mitchum, Kirk Douglas in what was one of his first starring roles, the great Jane Greer we talked about last week, and in a small role, Rhonda Fleming is so good in this, but everybody top to bottom, the young mute who's the friend of Mitchum's character, he's fantastic, top to bottom.
He's crucial, Dickie Moore, as the kid. You'll note when the film starts, too. This would have been shocking at the time. Shocking in its quality. You'll probably agree. The aspect of older films that is dated the least well is rear projection.
Mm.
You're looking at that and you're thinking, oh, no. It's someone clearly in front of a screen, and it doesn't even look like they're in that place they're supposed to be in. So the camera is with the car as we roll into town. We are in the picture. We're moving with the car. It's a great device to get you involved and to set up that we're going to be going down this road. I was thinking about other films that start with an entry, a road-based entry into town or a kind of citadel of the dead. Rio Bravo starts in a similar fashion, and Night of the Living Dead starts in a similar fashion. It's an effective way to put the viewer in the picture. And so then we have Stefanos Joe rolling into town, played by Paul Valentine, who was a dancer. And really, for most of the people in this film, except the obvious exceptions, it's going to be the artistic highlight of their career. Paul Valentine, for instance, in 1980, a guy like Mr. Richard Kimball watching TV one night could have seen him playing a maitre d' in his favorite TV series, The Ropers. So, Ropers
wow.
is quite far afield, temporally, artistically, culturally, from out of the past. I don't know how you go from the one to the other over the span of those decades, but so it went. For Stefanos, who is dumped headlong into the river, courtesy of the kid who saves Mitchum's life. I've seen this film so many times. I've seen it in the theater many times. I have, as I mentioned to you once, gone to the theater and, quote unquote, watched it with my eyes closed and just had it function as a piece of sound art, because Mitchum's voice is crucial to this movie and what it's going to achieve with that voiceover narration. It's such a pure example of storytelling. Even more than a movie, this is a story. And you need that narrative voice to have it be that full-fledged flowering of story, which is exactly what we get.
And Jane Greer was pretty young at the time, but she is so strong in this because it's not the typical femme fatale role.
It's not because of how wicked she is, but it's also the definitive femme fatale. You cannot be more maledict than this character is in this story.
Mm.
She's bad.
Oh, yeah.
She is. Sometimes I think people will look back on people that they were with whom they shouldn't have been. And in Kathy Moffat, they see an element of that. Maybe at the time, because they were hurting, they overrated how bad that person was, although they were terrible. Kathy Moffat, you can't overrate how evil she is. I mean, it's pure evil, and yet she's pure seductress at the same time. You want to be with her. I mean, she's absolutely beautiful, and she's beautiful in a way that's singular. There isn't anyone who looks like her or commands the screen as Jane Greer does in this film, or commands the cafe that the Mitchum character meets her in Mexico, the way when she walks in out of the sunlight. I mean, it's like something out of fiction, the way his voiceover works. And then she came in out of the sunlight, and he's almost like sort of blinded the way she's the light streaming in and the white that she's wearing, because in the beginning of this film, before you know that she's just like his, reprehensible as someone can be, her costuming matches. She's in white, and that was done on purpose, of course. But when Mitchum accurately summarizes her later on, when we're out of the flashback and his character is at Witt's mansion, his Tahoe estate, and all that stuff, I've seen people lately complaining. Again, you just have to. The whole safe space culture, complaining about the way he talks to her. She's malevolent. She's not misogynistic. She is that evil. He lets her off light, verbally speaking.
And every time she does something evil and shows both Mitchum and us who she truly is, something about that character and that actress make you want to give her another chance.
You do. That's the worst kind of person.
Oh, yeah.
That messed up your life is that person. When you've seen it and you've like accepted it and then you barter with yourself and whatever they're offering you, physically, sexually, emotionally, psychologically, or just even in terms of hope that people can turn a corner. You start thinking, once I did this and I don't do that anymore. And there's a reason that they were able to ensnare you or convince you or win you over or have you love them in the first place. So you're vulnerable. And Mitchum he's vulnerable to Kathy Moffat in this film. And he even sort of writes his own tombstone farewell when he's on that beach in Mexico. And he's supposed to bring her back to Witt, who she's shot and lied about stealing his money, because we find out that she did steal that money. And she's saying, you don't want to do this. And he says that famous line, baby, I don't care. And he doesn't, or he thinks he doesn't. And it's just not going to work out that the way he wants it to. And she is the femme fatale, and yet there is no femme fatale like Kathy Moffat.
Kirk Douglas, a very young, I think maybe 29 or so when he made the film, but already such a commanding presence on screen.
Right, and Douglas and Mitchum size each other up in that early scene when Mitchum and his partner are brought in to Douglas's office, or his home, where he's been shot. And you notice that the Stefanos and Jack Fisher, who is the Mitchum character's partner, they're each trying to do these lines, like these kind of film noir tough guy lines. It's a very self-aware movie. And both Mitchum and Kirk Douglas, they cut right through that. They're like, we're not doing these lines. And you right away see this connection between the two of them, where the Douglas character says to Mitchum, you just stay within yourself. You just listen. And there's some life advice in that. He's picking out this thing that's a valuable quality to have in life that very few people have, because most people, they just simply want to talk and they want an audience, whether the audience wants to be there or not. And I was looking to at these James Agee. He was writing about this film. He wrote about this film twice. And he really liked Kirk Douglas. So in his first little mini review, it's funny because A.G. just, he loves to hate films, is what I think sometimes, even though he's a very good writer. Conventional private eye melodrama. You like that? Conventional. It's so not conventional, A.G. More good work by Musaraka. That would be Nicholas Musaraka, the cinematographer. Largely wasted. Kirk Douglas, wasted as usual. It's his third film, man. I mean, what has he seen? Is he gone to the future? Bob Mitchum is so very sleepily self-confident with the women that when he slopes into clinches, you expect him to snore in their faces. That's what he asked for review number one. That's more positive than the second one. He says, in which he upgrades it to a medium-grade thriller about a not very smart young man who is hired to hound down the runaway mistress of a hard guy. Mitchum finds the girl, sets up housekeeping with her, and lets himself in for no end of melodramatic consequences. Fairly well played and very well photographed by Nicholas Musaraka, the action develops a routine kind of pseudo-tension. Yeah, I don't know about that, man. I think that's as wrong as you can be about this film. I don't know if he was on deadline or something, or trying to be James Agee edgelord, but it's just inaccurate.
Movie also contains my favorite character name, I think, in any movie when it comes to bad guys, the lawyer Leonard Eels.
But Eels is a bad guy, but if you just watch the film, he's not a bad guy.
No.
You can miss why he's a bad guy. His actual conduct and demeanor isn't bad guy-esque, but he has helped Witt defraud the government. And he's blackmailing him, which is the greater crime, I guess. The worst of the two sins. I know exactly, I mentioned this to you before, but I know exactly why people cannot follow this film. And it's notorious for being unfollowable after a certain point. We have flashbacks. We have that kind of thing. It's when the Mitchum character goes to the apartment of Meta Carson, the secretary for Leonard Eales, to get these crucial papers. So we know whose apartment we're in. Then we see Kathy Moffat, but we don't think it's Kathy Moffat at first. We're totally confused. Why is she in Meta Carson's apartment? Is she impersonating Meta Carson? Is Meta Carson impersonating her? That's where it gets confusing. You lose your footing for a few seconds in the film when you don't know what's going on there. And if it's your first viewing, it can be hard to get that footing again. So that's why I think people get confused and might write this film off in a way that they shouldn't.
And I think a lot of times, too, even beyond the first viewing of it, you find yourself saying, where's Jeff going and why is he going there again? What's the reason behind this? Because this makes no sense to me. But at some point, you also don't care because you just want to go along for that ride.
If you vet it again, though, it does make sense. It's not like to have and have not, which is like, whatever, we'll just do this. Or these films where certain of the noir films, they're just experience and atmosphere films and crackling dialogue films. You can storyboard this. This is real. The plot actually does hold up. You just have to slow down, if you can, when you watch the movie. You're given such a chunk of the movie in flashback on this drive with the current girlfriend. You really want that to work out because she seems sweet and the Mitchum character is in a good place in his life before his past comes roaring up, literally, to get him, which is the lesson of the film, that sometimes you never escape that past. But it actually does make sense plot-wise. There isn't really anything that is even that over the top or outre. It functions. It's just thick. It's not light. There is a lot happening in this movie. It's like a piece of music that is, it just has a lot of notes and not a lot of rest. You're getting that barrage. You're getting John Coltrane in 1966 rather than Coltrane with the Miles Davis Band in the mid-50s.
And all the times I've seen this film, I still keep getting pulled in and I still have that incredible feeling of dread when Jeff gets in that car with Kathy at the end.
Mitchum and film noir never really did so well with cars. There's another one, Angel Face, where the car goes in reverse and he goes to his horrible death. But cars, they were these just weapons of existential destruction, that, or at least they could be, in crime pictures of this era. And I think it's interesting, too, that in this film, we have to consider how versatile its director, Jacques Tornor, was. There are really three key contributions to film history from Tornor, this being one of them. 1942, he had done Cat People. Musaraka was the cinematographer for that as well. He did some other pictures with Val Luden that didn't reach the same mark. And then 10 years after Out of the Past, he made Night of the Demon, which, of course, is the adaptation of the M.R. James story, Casting the Runes. And one of the great horror films, one of the great English horror films, and just this kind of classic era horror picture that was a thinking person's horror picture. It was cerebral. Tornor, he has you think. He's like Howard Hawks that way. You have to think and pick your way through these things. You're involved. I think that's why that opening shot is such a setter of tone and perspective, that you need to be in this movie. We're not just going to tell you everything, dumbasses. You're going to have to work with the art. And that's really how the best art functions. You're involved. You're almost a co-creator. You're a collaborator. And when Mitchum gets in that car before he gets himself shot in the, well, where do you want to get shot, but you don't want to get shot where he gets shot, at least there's the redemption of he's made the right choice. He's done the right thing. He leaves this world redeemed, if he ever even really sin that much, and he didn't. He got caught up in this maelstromic presence that any of us, you, me, I mean, if we met this woman, Kimball, we'd be like going at it. I'd be like, Kimball, come on, man. I got all those stairs. I'm strong. You know that I deserve this. And you'd be like, no, I've been a teacher for a long time. I can be gentle with her in ways that you can't see, dog. We'd throw, Kimball.
You know what I didn't know until I was doing a little research here, and once I read it, I said, well, of course, I didn't realize that the 84 film Against All Odds was essentially a remake, not a great one, of Out of the Past.
Yeah, it was. And after a certain year, because so many early films were remakes, and people tend not to know that, I don't know how you remake something like this. I don't know why you would. It's baffling to me. The film itself was quite an overhaul of the novel. I've written about both many times. The novel featured a non-Mitchum-like male lead. And he was quite a bit older, too. So there's a bigger age gap between that character and in his various women. It's more naturalistic. It's in nature more. And you know what? This is interesting, too, because there are parts of this film. We don't get a lot of this. Nature noir. It's not really something that happens. Mm. We are in the great outdoors, away from the city, quite often and out of the
right.
past,
mm.
which I think is cool. And it certainly isn't diminished as noir, even though you can practically smell the pine and breathe in the fresh air of aspects. We're out on the beautiful beach in Mexico. We're out in the Pacific Northwest. We're fishing for trout, Kimball. I mean, it's just very sort of, oh, look, there's James Audubon tramping by. I love that. It's a very versatile film, even within itself.
I don't know which one of us would land Jane Greer. She was married to Rudy Vallee briefly. Maybe if I could sing into the old megaphone like Rudy did back in the day.
Well, put it this way. It's one of those things where if you won initially, you'd be like, yeah, I'm Kimball, I still got it. And I'd be crestfallen, but later on I'd be like, oh, yeah, that was cool. It worked out better for me.
Yeah, there I am getting
like
in that car,
night,
yeah.
Like a late night text from you. You'd be talking Mitchum speak. I think I'm in the frame. Well, Jeff, you're right. You're all like riding your stick like Dave Tiger Williams around the rink after you scored a goal when you pulled Kathy Moffitt. What do you think is going to happen now? Don't get shot in the dick, Kimball.
Nobody wants to go that way. Colin Fleming, every Tuesday here on Downtown. Hey, look, if you've never seen Out of the Past, do yourself a favor. Watch it. If you've seen it and haven't for a while, go watch it again. It's one of those movies. Well, thanks to TCM, it's on at least once a month, and I try to watch it every chance I get.
Kimball, name a more rewatchable movie than Out of the Past. If it's your favorite movie or one of your favorite movies, your first viewing and your 50th viewing is just a great movie to always watch. I don't know a movie that I can rewatch Scrooge and this more readily, though, than those two films.
I never miss it if it's on. Great stuff. Out of the Past. Colin Fleming with us on Downtown. Colin, we'll check in with you again next Tuesday.
All right. Sounds good, Kimball.